The Puritans were first on the scene, and the notion of Puritanism in conjunction with the state was the Holy Commonwealth. That is, it wasn't to be a theocracy like Iran. It was to be, or like Calvin's Geneva, but it was to be, America was to be a nation in which the civil estate and the ecclesiastical estate would be working closely together, but one would not dominate the other. The notion was that the people who were making the laws and executing justice and running the commerce of the country would also be part of the church. But it wasn't the idea that the church would run the state, or that that the churches would be under the domination of the state, but that working cooperatively, the kingdom of God, as it were, would be created on the new American continent. The notion also was one of Calvinistic orthodoxy, and that is, you don't go out into the highways and byways and bring people in, but the people that are already in the town, as it were, are part of the church. So it's just expected that people would live up to their feeling that they may be of the chosen, of the elect, in God's predestinarian scheme of things, electing some to salvation and some to damnation. Whitfield, however, comes and begins preaching outside the churches, and this is an innovation, and this divides the old Calvinists, the old Presbyterians, the old Congregationalists, between those who think that this is a good idea for reviving religious feeling and faith in these years around the turn of the century, around 1710, 1720, when people in droves were staying away from the churches, and those who thought that those measures were not good. These are the old siders and the new siders. Part of the new siders was Jonathan Edwards. And Jonathan Edwards strongly backed Whitfield. Here he is, 24 years old, preaching all over the country. Benjamin Franklin gives him money. Strongly supported these innovative techniques of introducing people to the Christian faith. So we can see that from the very beginning, the point I'm making is that from the very beginning, America has been a place of religious innovation. If you want to see the continuation of Puritanism, you would look to the United Church of Christ. They are the inheritors of the Puritan, Congregationalist kind of Christianity. In fact, some churches even today, many years after the formation of the United Church of Christ, will have congregational church. In fact, our church in Pullman is the Congregational United Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ people don't, you know, the higher level people don't like that because they want to inculcate the denominational identity. But the congregational name has been associated in the American religious history as sort of the upper crust, prestigious place to go and name. And I once heard a preacher from the East, from the old stronghold of Congregationalism, preach a sermon, and it wasn't about hellfire and damnation at all, of course. But it was about social responsibility and how people, the typical liberal line that a lot of us like, So I wasn't against that, and I wasn't against the sermon at all. But I was just thinking, and it was a woman, of course. That would never be the case in old style congregationalism. But if you just sort of turned off the audio, and you could see this. Very severe, it's back to 1725 in Northampton, Massachusetts. It was, and especially as a Lutheran, I thought, it wasn't
what I would consider a gospel sermon. It was a law sermon. Or, you know, this is what you should do. And this is the shape of society, the way society should be shaped. I remember having a discussion with my Presbyterian colleague at UC Santa Barbara when I was agonizing, I think this was in 76 or 77, about whether or not I should give an invocation at the commencement. I had been invited to do so. And I wrestled with that. I finally decided to do it. But as I discussed this with Bill, my Presbyterian colleague, I thought I was making persuasive arguments for not doing it. You know? And I could see him kind of going with those arguments and then pulling back. Because from his Calvinist heritage, there is this residual sense that the Christian faith is going to transform society. Now, Lutherans don't think that. Lutherans talk about the two kingdoms. That there's a kingdom of God that is executed in terms of law, in terms of power, in terms of retribution. You do wrong, you land in jail. You do right, you'll be okay. And there's another kingdom, which is the kingdom of God's right hand, which is governed by the rules of mercy and justice that and manna and mercy that Dan Erlander talks about. See? And these two realms are two ways in which God governs the world. So that from the Lutheran point of view, the gospel is the motivating force for those who hear the gospel and are in the church and that operate by justification, by grace, and by forgiveness and mercy. But the state stays as it is. It's good, it's holy, but it's not going to be the kingdom of God in a theological sense. That's in the church. So you have the two kingdoms theory. Well, what has resulted from that is a quietism that Lutherans have been accused of. A quietism meaning you can let all sorts of evils go on in the kingdom of the left hand as long as the government allows the preaching of the gospel so that the kingdom of the right hand can flourish. Well, the reductio ad absurdum of that is Hitler's Germany, of course, where you know many Lutherans acquiesce in Hitler's atrocities because, presumably, Hitler allowed the preaching of the gospel. Of course, if you preach the gospel in such a way that it criticized Nazism, you would probably be in serious trouble, right? So there are very different approaches to this notion of how the faith interacts with the secular world, as it were. So, on from Puritanism, I think of a dissenter from Puritanism, Roger Williams. You know that name. Roger Williams is the name behind the Baptist movement in this country. Roger Williams was a Puritan preacher in the Massachusetts Bay Colony who felt that there should be some independence, independent thinking and independent acting. And that every last detail of life should not be determined by the divines, by the clergy. Well, the clergy didn't like that, and they expelled Roger Williams from that colony because of his ideas of religious liberty. And that is the essential notion of the Baptist tradition, is religious liberty and a strict separation between church and state. Now, if that isn't a religious innovation, what is? Because throughout most of human history, since we crawled out of the mud, church and state, as it were, have been combined. When you think of traditional societies that the Malinowskis of this world investigated, they don't even have a word for religion. Native Americans don't have a word for religion because what you do in your life and what you do in your religious life are coterminous. Nothing is not religious, yeah.
Where did the Baptist originate? You said that was in this country. Does it come from the old country, so to speak? I have a question.
Yeah. There were a number of reformations. We Lutherans think of one reformation and then a bunch of weird people that didn't agree with Luther, right? That was my impression when I was growing up. But there was the Tudor Reformation in England. There was the Conservative Reformation, that's the Luther Reformation, that wanted to keep Catholicism and all its good parts and eliminate only that which contravened the gospel. That's a conservative Reformation. The Baptist tradition comes out of the Radical Reformation. And the Radical Reformation is a root and branch Reformation. That is, you don't trim the tree, uproot the tree, and plant a new one. And when you take a Luther who takes his stand on an individual basis, and you eliminate the sense of continuity with the past, which Luther very definitely had, and which Lutherans have to this day, when you eliminate that, sort of turn toward Rome, and you've taken the individual who is free with his Bible or her Bible to live before God, you have the beginnings of the Baptist movement. You add to that a kind of rationalism that the Radical Reformation emphasized. That is, the reason can understand the Bible, and in order for you to be a fully practicing Christian, you have to make a decision. You have to look at the options before you and decide for Christ. The Lutheran emphasis was on what God was doing, not your response. But the Radical Reformation, while not denying the grace of God at all, stressed the decisional character of faith, and then acting that out in a way that shows very definitely you're not of the world. So, for example, you don't get baptized when you're an infant because you cannot rationally decide. So you're dedicated to God as an infant. But then at, you know, quote, confirmation age or bar mitzvah age, you would supposedly, you know, you examine the options and then you make a decision for Christ. And then you are a Christian. So what you get from the Radical Reformation is a believer's church, not something that you're sort of born into, but something which you decide to join. Okay? And, you know, from that you also get the Hutterites and the Quakers, and you get many different movements, yeah.
I thought it might be interesting when you mentioned Baptist, because I can just see it, and I have a copy of it. My forefathers, in fact, is my grandfather, as a young child, with his family, came from Sweden, and I've looked up those records in Sweden and made copies of it. And the Lutheran, the Preston that covered the area, he kept track of everybody, whether they came to communion and, you know, and all this, you know, very... It's all in there. And it was very spotty attendance there for a year or two. And then, I can't remember, it's April something, 1869, just written kind of diagonally across this page where they kept track of all the communions and everything for the family. There were four or five in the family plus the parents. It's just written America, A-M-E-R-I-K-A, America, Baptists. In other words, and then they were Baptists. In other words, that finishes them. This is why I'm out of here, because they weren't coming to the Lutheran Church anyhow. And so they came over, and we're in northwestern Wisconsin, and the records show there that one of the biggest Baptist congregations in the U.S., as I understand it from what I was in in Burnett County, you know, now in Trade Lake Baptist mm-hmm. Church. You know, early on, that was uh-huh. like in the 1870, 1880. And, well, then my family went back to Lutheranism, but anyhow, that was, when you said Baptist, I thought, gee, but apparently
they go way back.
Sort of infiltrated into Sweden, see, and that was a bad element because right. the church, they had to be all Lutherans in Sweden.
Right. Some of those people became covenanters, Swedish yeah, right. covenanters. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the other
yeah.
one.
So you have these, and the Swedish covenanters are here in the U.S. today, and it's simply the Covenant Church, Evangelical Covenant Church. They dropped the Swedish stuff long ago. But I would imagine that if you go into Evangelical Covenant Churches, you'll find a lot of Ekbergs and Sundbergs. And
yeah. There's another word there, Philadelphia. What is that? I think the love, there's a Philadelphia church.
Yeah, that's William Penn. That's Quakerism.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to talk about him next. Yeah. Okay. So the one of the fundamental impulses of the Baptist movement is the sense of persecution by a controlling state church, a broad church, a consensual church, a church that it's easy to get flaccid in spiritually, and the idea of individual interpretation of the scriptures, and that the final court of appeal is the individual. When you look at that politically or in terms of church polity, the final court of appeal is the local church. So that it's a radical congregationalism on the one hand. The other end of the spectrum is Roman Catholicism, where the final court of appeal is the Pope, and where you have a hierarchical system. In the middle would be some forms of Lutheranism and Presbyterianism, particularly Presbyterianism. Calvin wanted to put together a polity, an ecclesiology, that kept some of the good parts of hierarchical systems. That is, for example, accountability to somebody other than, you know, you and your friends. World missions, for example. And some of the emphases of congregationalism. So that's Presbyterian polity, kind of in the middle between these two extremes. Roger Williams gets kicked out of Massachusetts Bay Colony for being an independent, and he goes to the sewage dump of colonial America, which is Rhode Island, right? I mean, that was the cesspool. Nobody wanted to go there.
Why?
Because it wasn't civilized. There were ruffians. It wasn't, you know, set up like the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It was just like a campground where people were ruffians and, you know, unrespectable people. And Williams goes there and starts a respectable colony. And eventually Providence, Rhode Island appears. Notice the name. You know, it's a religious name. Brown University appears, which was a Baptist university. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I was going to mention that you were saying 1860s, 1870s. The Baptist movement, because it emphasizes individual interpretation, is fertile ground for both conservatism and liberalism. And when we get to talking about the fundamentalist modernist controversy, we're going to see that it ripped apart the Baptists in this country. It ripped apart the Presbyterians in this country. Because when you introduce this idea of individual interpretation, conservatives can say, well, this is the way it is, and liberals can say, well, this is the way it is, and who's to say, where's the court of appeal? You know, it's clear where that is in Rome, or at least pre-Vatican II Rome. But there is no final court of appeal, and this is what's so, well, look at the Southern Baptist Convention. They're ripping themselves apart. And while you have this extreme congregationalism, You also have to get some things done cooperatively, unless every single congregation is going to own a printing press, you know, and have an author for the Sunday school materials, and you know, maybe it's going to take at least two or three congregations to send a missionary out. So there are a few things that we have to do together. So the Southern Baptist Convention, which is not a church, supposedly, is a kind of way in which individuals in individual congregations can cooperate in the mission of Christ. And if you can get control of the boards of those those cooperative entities, bingo, you've got control of what? The money. And this is what the fundamentalist faction did. About 12, 13 years ago, a group of fundamentalistically inclined Southern Baptists. Now, the Southern Baptist Convention is conservative, but it's broad. It's like the state church that draws. So it's a fairly, within the conservative spectrum, fairly accommodationistic. Very, very culture friendly in the South. You know, in the South, in Alabama, places like that, you're Southern Baptist whether you want to be or not. You just are. You know, it's like in Sweden, you're a Lutheran. That's it. You can't not be. You know, and they pray at football games. Brother Billy Bob gets up and gives a, you know, thing. Well, a group of fundamentalistically inclined Southern Baptists gathered at the Café du Mont, you know where that is in New Orleans, that open thing with the columns, and you get your beignet, and you get mug of coffee and sit there and watch the people go by. Well, they got their beignets and they decided to take over the denomination, and that's the way they did it. They decided to take control of these boards, like the Sunday school board, like the publishing house, and the boards of trustees of the seminaries. And they did it in about 10 years. Then they went back to the cafe and celebrated. Of course, they didn't have any wine, but they had some coffee. Celebrated their victory. And now the Southern Baptist Convention, qua Southern Baptist Convention, is a fundamentalist denomination, whereas 15 years ago, it was a broad kind of coalition in which there were lots of fundamentalists, but there were also lots of more moderate conservative Christians. But after the Civil War, you had the Northern Baptists and the Southern Baptists split over the slavery issue. And then later in the 1920s, you had big battles, even before the 1920s, big battles in the Northern Baptists between the conservatives and liberals. Harry Emerson Fosdick, for example, was a Baptist, even though he preached at First Presbyterian Church in New York City. His famous sermon, "Shall Fundamentalists Win?" They didn't. They lost. That's the end of that story. William Penn was a religious innovator. I was going to get back to what I was saying before about the inability to distinguish between religion and non-religious activities in traditional cultures. So throughout most of history, you really couldn't say this is the religious life and this is the, you know, not religious, the secular life. In the medieval times, we talked about the medieval synthesis, meaning that under the aegis of the Christian faith, all branches of knowledge and human endeavor can be synthesized. So that theology is the queen of sciences. It's at the top of the pyramid of knowledge. So a very close connection between what's religious and what's, quote, not religious. We talk about medieval times as the age of belief. And I would say it was impossible not to believe in those days. Huh? Now, of course, in the privacy of your own mind, you could say, this is bullshit, you know, or whatever medieval people said, the equivalent, you know. But the public life was a life of belief. Huh? that belief was mandatory. Belief was expected. And it's not until the very, very recent past, the past that includes a Roger Williams, that would say there's a separation of powers here. And the civil government has no right to dictate in the religious realm whatsoever. As I said yesterday, the test case of that is dead Christian Science kids. But up to that, up to the corpse of a Christian Science kid, most people, I think, in America have bought into the religious freedom idea. Or the test case could be brainwashing and kidnapping and deprogramming. And that's another test case. We believe that people have the freedom to be strange, to be behaviorally deviant. But do we believe that they have the right to have their brain sucked out and somebody else's ideology injected? Now, I don't believe that. I think my position is there's no such thing as brainwashing. Because to assert that there's brainwashing, you have to believe that there is a mind that's dirtied from the outside. I mean, obviously, people don't dirty their own mind, right? They are dirty. And so one must wash them clean from all that junk that somebody has injected in there. It assumes that the person is passive. And I'm not saying that there aren't manipulative people, yes, and gullible people, but manipulative people gull. Yes, that's true. In other words, there's a lot of crazy, bad stuff that happens in religion. The key question is the government going to tell us which are the good religions, the clean religions, and which are the dirty religions, that from which your brain has to be washed? And in order to get you in a situation in which you can get your brain washed, you have to be kidnapped. And that's what it is. You know, we were talking about Waco. People that were called by the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people were the anti-cult business people. There's an anti-cult business in this country. And if there weren't, well, the anti-cult business has an interest in painting new religious movements in the worst possible way, casting them in the worst possible light, so that the anti-cult business can make money. I mean, that's a very cynical way of looking at it, but I think that's the case. If you would say, yes, there are tragic things that happen where young people join a totalist group, that's another word that I like, totalist. So new religious movement is very benign. Doesn't tell you much. Emergent religion is good. High intensity, now we're getting hotter here. And totalist, yeah, there are totalist groups. We have one in Pullman. When you sign on with Living Faith Fellowship in Pullman, Washington, your life is not your own. Your life is theirs. And people love it. They thrive on that. You know, they want to make a decision about getting a new car. They schedule an appointment with the Pastor Fred. You know, and they discuss it, and they are led to the godly decision about their car, or about their kid's marriage, or about, you know, umpty-dumpty things. People thrive on that. They love it. You and I think that our church is kind of an adjunct to life, with a capital L, right? I mean, some people are kind of professional church junkies, you know, they're there all the time. And every parish has them, and the parish can go without them, you know. They're volunteer secretaries, they're on 10 committees, blah, blah, blah. You know, 20% of the people do 80% of the work, that kind of thing. But, in general, our Christian congregations, for us, are places where we get strength and insight for life, right? They're not like in a medieval village where it's right in the center, you know, and everything centers around, or in a Thai village, where the Wat or the, you know, the monk, the monastery is right in the center and is the center of life. With Living Faith Fellowship, that is your life. You know, you go off to your job or whatnot, but when you come home, you get ready to go to the potluck or to the lecture or whatever. It's totalist, and it answers all your questions. It's not an adjunct to your journey. What's this journey business, huh? It's here are the answers. God's word is, to use a weird Reformation word, is the Bible and the official interpretation of this church, because the Bible is not perspicacious. It's not obviously the case with just a casual reading. The Reformation said, no, the Bible is perspicacious, and you can read it and find out what God intends by reading the Bible. So it's you and the Bible. Now, Luther said, yes, but the church also. See? But if you axe off that church part, you get me and the Bible, right? Well, what happens next in the Enlightenment? You lop off the Bible part and you get just I. You see the progression from a very communalist kind of an emphasis in Roman Catholicism to a democratizing tendency, but with a community in the Reformation. And then you get the Radical Reformation, where it's just I and the Bible. And I find from the Bible X, Y, and Z. And then I talk to you and I say, what do you believe? And you say X, Y, and Z. Hey, brother, all right. You know, and so the church is a conglomeration of individuals who are individually related to God and then fellowship with one another because each is individually related to God and saying the same thing. Well, what happens when you lop off the Bible? You just get, you know, the introspective self and world, not self-mediated through any kind of authoritative scriptures. I am the authority. Well, okay. We go till 5:30.
Pause.
The next thing that I want to say is something about, pen. Yeah, let's get into pen. Penn's innovation was that he opened his colony to anybody who believed in the Supreme Being. If you said you believe in God, you're a candidate to live in Penn's Woods, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Was this before or after he got all the deeded land, or he got a lot of land, didn't he?
I believe yes, that's right.
He got a tremendous chunk of land from the government. I was wondering if is his religious enlightenment before or after that, do you know?
Well, Penn came from the from England, a Quaker.
Okay.
So I'm not familiar with all the
land was given to his
He got the land specifically for a Quaker colony, and
okay.
It was viewed as mountainous.
Okay.
I mean, there was the harbor at Philadelphia, but then when you go out fairly quickly, you hit the mountains.
Okay.
And there was less interest in that, and there was also very little sea coast in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I mean, there was only the Delaware River there. And so it was much less desirable than any other place.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Right. So the angle that I'm coming at it from is the angle of new religious movement.
Right.
And this was, because in the other colonies, you had doctrinal tests, less so in Rhode Island, but certainly in the others, you know, Virginia and New Jersey and the other colonies had theological requirements for you to be a functioning member of that community. But Penn welcomed anybody who believed in God, so that was the only criterion. And that was a real departure from tradition. Let me do a 15-second factoid bite on Quakerism, just so you all are checked out on that. George Fox, 18th century, took the principle of individual interpretation to its absolute limit within the bounds of the Christian faith. And he said that the light of God comes to us internally. It is not mediated by sacraments. Sacramental Christians say that God has given us gifts like baptism, like Eucharist, like the spoken word, as a conduit for the word of God, for the ideas of God, for the power of God, for the light of God. Fox said, we don't need those. God comes to us directly. You don't need the mediation of any priest. Now, certainly Luther said that, right? So Fox eliminates all, not only priests, but sacraments, and individualizes the faith. And Fox was a great guy, and he was fun. He and his followers used to streak churches. I mean, really, they did. So they were persona non grata.
They would run through churches
naked. To show, kind of like a koan, you know, to jolt the people into realizing that all of this stuff that they were doing, this ritual that they were doing, was a sham. It got in the way of the direct communication of the soul with God. You don't need all these external things. In fact, the external things keep you from God. So a Quaker meeting is a quiet meeting. It's not a meeting at which some ordained person is mediating the light of God to you. You are experiencing the light of God inside, the inner light. And then if you feel moved to say something that comes out of your own religious experience and that might be of help to your friends, right, the friend society, then you say that. But if you don't feel moved, you don't say anything. The Quakers meet at the Campus Christian Center and on Sunday morning, and sometimes I come in there to get something from my office. You know, you've been in this situation where you just know somebody's in the room but you can't see them, you know, like around the corner, you don't want to go and look, but you just sense that somebody's there and there's maybe breathing or something, but they're sitting in a circle and just quietly meditating. Okay, Second Great Awakening. We talked about the First Great Awakening, which goes from about 1725 for 25, 30 years.
That was Williams from the... Who was the...
Roger Williams?
Roger Williams, the leader of that?
No, that was Jonathan Edwards. Yeah. The Second Great Awakening gets going at the end of the century, 1795, and propels American Christianity toward the Civil War in an evangelical direction. So that out of the Second Great Awakening, you have an evangelical stamp on the bulk of American Christianity until the 1920s. So it was a major, major movement. One of the centerpieces of the Second Great Awakening was the revivalist movement. Early in the century, you had the Cane Ridge, early in the 19th century, you had the Cane Ridge Revival in Kentucky, where you had literally thousands of people. This is amazing on the frontier, you know, where there weren't very many people. But you'd have the hundreds and the thousands of individuals and families who would come for, you know, tens of hundreds of miles around to camp for a week, 10 days, in their family groups, and spend the day studying the Bible, and then at night they would have a revival. And they would have a preacher who would fire up the people to believe more fervently in Christ and devote their lives to God. What was, now doesn't this sound a little bit like Whitfield's preaching? Yes. One of the innovations that you had in the Second Great Awakening was the manipulation of crowds, was the careful presentation of the gospel in a particular setting. You just didn't go out there and start to preach. You made sure that the tent was up, and you made sure that you had ushers. And in other words, it was a more structured kind of movement than the First Great Awakening. Name to remember is Charles Finney, died 1875. Finney was one of the first ones to kind of use these manipulative techniques like the anxious bench. I don't know if I mentioned that. He'd have a bench in front of his congregations in these revivals. And he would say to the people, you know, I know there are some people out there who are ready to give their lives to Christ, but they're not quite ready. They need to think about this and they need to pray about it. You know, come up here and sit. And then he would, you know, harangue them until they came to the altar and gave their lives to Christ. And then he would have some people like Billy Graham does today, you know, counselors who will pray with them and bring them deeper into the faith. So many of the techniques that the Billy Sundays of this world and the Amy Semple McPhersons of this world in the 20s of this century and Billy Graham, you know, epitomized, were beginning to be developed in the Second Great Awakening in the 1820s, 30s, 40s. Now, what do I mean by evangelical stamp? I mean that mainstream American religion during the 19th and early 20th centuries emphasized the personal, emotional attachment between the individual and Christ, maintained the deity of Christ, in other words, a high Christology, was mission-oriented, conversionistic-oriented, recruitment-oriented, had a high view of the Bible, and was interested in social welfare, which is one of the features of fundamentalism that drops off in the fundamentalist age. Maybe I'll get to that in a minute. The era of the evangelical revivals of the period before World War, I mean before the war between the states, as the Southerners called it, the Civil War, was a period of tremendous building of hospitals and orphanages and other institutions of amelioration of society's ills. This was not the social gospel where you criticize the structures of society itself along, let's say, socialist lines. Rather, the evangelical impulse is out of the love of God to create institutions in which people can be helped. Hospitals are a perfect example of that. And if you go back into the history of most hospitals, I mean, not these healthcare facilities, you know, and whatever else they're called today that are, you know, that advertise, isn't that the weirdest thing? You know, get your operation here, get a free, you know, ticket to Disneyland or something. But, you know, most hospitals that are more than 10 or 15 years old probably have a history that's embedded in the Second Great Awakening. The evangelical impulse to help people in society.
Didn't the Sunday school movement also start that?
Uh-huh, yeah, right. And that had a social impulse also, because the Sunday school movement was aimed at poor boys and girls who on Sunday would be out on the street getting into trouble. So the idea of the Sunday school, I mean, these were kids that probably didn't get any education at all. In the regular public schools, they would get, you know, McGuffey's Reader and that sort of thing. They would get a sort of moral education. But the low dregs of society wouldn't get any kind of moral direction whatsoever. So the Sunday school movement wanted to bring these poor kids in and help them. There was tremendous opposition to the Sunday school movement in the 19th century from the churches, some churches, who said that this was taking the responsibility of moral and religious education away from the parents and concentrating it in other hands. God had ordained the parents to be the moral and religious educators of the kids. Nothing's easy. You think, who could oppose Sunday school? You know, that's the last thing anybody would oppose. No, there was a tremendous hue and cry against the Sunday school. My that's one dictum. Nothing is easy. My other dictum is, everything is fundraising. Now you think about that. When you get real cynical, you know, sometimes, you just look at everything. It's all fundraising. Fundamentalism is fundraising. If they lost their nerve, you know, and really didn't believe that God was going to eternally damn a bunch of people, how would they raise money? In the deepest dark secrets of midnight, you know, these fundamentalist guys are saying, I know it's true. I know God is not going to crush people in hell. I know that. But if I let that dirty secret out, nobody's going to send me a dime, because I'm saving all these people from hell.
Televangelists.
That's right. Well, I think what I'm going to do is this chart.
Okay?
Because we've got 7 minutes, 7 official minutes. Yeah.
You were going to talk about New Age.
Well, I think we can do that tomorrow.
Okay.
It looks like you can come just about any time, because you've been here
a
lot. So, yeah, New Age doesn't exactly fit in right now, except at the bottom here.
Yeah.
And so when I get to the bottom, we'll be ready to go tomorrow into New Age. I'll do the New Age. Let's say that tomorrow, so we're not supposed to talk about the past here, but we can talk about the future. Right? So you can come and bring your friends. And let's say that tomorrow will be the kind of catch-all. I won't have a chart, and I'll just say, you know, I'll do the New Age first, and then we'll, whatever else you want to talk about, okay? I'll give you a piece of paper that has the 17 families of religions in this country. So this will enable you to amaze all your friends, because you can, you know, at any cocktail party, you can whip this out and say, well, that religion fits here. And so you can have a complete taxonomic system for any religion that comes up of the 1,500 that are in this country. Recent American religious history. We've done Puritanism, we've done the First Great Awakening, and I'm starting recent American religious history with the post-Civil War period. So we probably should say 1865. Around 1860, you have this evangelical stamp that is personal religion of the heart, not a strong emphasis on doctrine, a strong emphasis on a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, a missionary impulse to convert people to Christianity, and a missionary impulse to make Christianity count in the amelioration of the ills of the world. Outreach, we would say. This is what Christianity looked like. This is what the Baptists looked like, and the Methodists looked like. And now the Lutherans are kind of off by themselves, because the Lutherans are ethnic chaplains. So the Lutherans have very little to do with mainstream America. You know, they've got funny names, like Italians have funny names too, to people, you know, named Smith and Edwards and Jones. But the basic evangelicalism applies also to the Lutherans. It doesn't apply to the other big ethnic chaplaincy. What? Roman Catholic, right. Undercurrent, modernism. So that while the
popular religion, popular Christianity, was characterized by evangelicalism. There was a strong undercurrent of modernism, that is, a system of thought that called into question many of the ideas of the evangelical majority. For example, the idea of the depravity of humans, a kind of pessimistic view of human nature. Modernism had an optimistic view of nature, human nature. While there was a lot of emphasis on the world to come in evangelicalism, in modernism there was more of an emphasis on this world and on social change. Whereas in evangelicalism, the notion was that God had, in the Bible, revealed a set of fixed principles that were the same and true throughout time and into eternity. The modernists were beginning to think about God as immanent in the processes of world history. So that where you discover God is not in a in infallible statements, as it were, whether backed up by Pope or Bible, but rather you discover God in history, in the processes of the ongoing evolutionary nature of the universe. And in the fundamentalist modernist controversy of the 1920s, all the way up to the battles of today over teaching evolution in schools, evolution has been one of the key points of contention between a more open, liberal, progressive kind of Christianity and a fundamentalist or evangelical kind of Christianity. By 1920, and certainly by 1925, erase that. Before 1920 and in the period 1920-1925 particularly, the mainstream evangelical folk had become more and more afraid of and hostile to those who had been converted to a more modernist interpretation of Christianity. Now here I'm condensing a lot into a little, because I'm not going to talk about all the different denominations, but you know, they mounted campaigns like the one in the Southern Baptist Convention in our recent history to drive the liberals out of the churches, to drive the liberals out of the Presbyterian Church, out of the American the Northern Baptist Church, out of the Disciples. There were these movements against modernism. Now, this is one of the key differences between evangelicals and fundamentalists. It's a matter not so much of kind as degree. Evangelicals are wimps. Fundamentalists are ferocious. Evangelicals are conservative. They're against modernism. They're against evolution. They want to have prayer in schools, blah, blah, blah. They think the Bible is inspired by God in all its parts. But they're willing to say that, and they'll let you say what you want to say. They're willing to say, this is our point of view. There are other points of view. Live and let live. We hope you'll come to our point of view. In fact, we might even come to your door and try to convince you about our point of view. The fundamentalists turn up the heat. They turn up the Bunsen burner under evangelicalism and make it raging, white, hot, mad at modernism, at everything that the modern age has on offer. And one of their principal bad things is evolution, because evolution leads to relativism and away from authority. Evolution puts humans in charge, dethrones God, before World War I, people were saying, look what evolution, or during World War I, the fundamentalists said, see what evolution leads to. Darwin's ideas were very influential in Germany, and in Germany, when you kick out God and put man in charge, feminists might say, yeah, that's right. Put men in charge, and this is what happened. You get this will to power, and they don't like Nietzsche either.
Surprise.
And so World War I was portrayed by the fundamentalists, and not only by the fundamentalists, but by them particularly, as the clash between Kultur and Christ. And the Allies were on the part of Christian civilization, and the Kaiser was the Antichrist, who was leading civilization to ruin. The official thing is over. I'll do this real quick so you'll get this. By 1925, the attempt of the fundamentalist evangelicals to take over the denominations failed. So that between 1920 and, let's say, 1976, but even in the 1930s, the main liberal mainstream was beginning to lose its grip on the American imagination. But to a great degree, from the 1920s on into the 50s and even the early 60s, the big liberal, non-fundamentalist, non-evangelical churches, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Episcopalians, American Baptists to a degree, were the denominations which were extremely influential in American life, which set the moral tone, which set the perimeters of the of moral debate. Leaders of these liberal Protestant churches were listened to, were quoted in the press. When an issue came up and Reinhold Niebuhr from Union Seminary said something about it, it was quoted on the front page of the New York Times. So the mainstream was very influential. Undercurrent, fundamentalist. After 1925, they didn't go away, they went underground. And they said, in effect, if we can't take over Yale and Princeton and Harvard and Chicago, I, Bob Jones, will start my own university. Bob Jones University. And so you have a whole evangelical subculture that nobody knew anything about except the millions and millions of people that inhabited it. But in the press, it was unknown. Nobody asked Bob Jones what he thought about the Korean War. Everybody wanted to know what Reinhold Niebuhr thought about it. He thought it was a pretty good idea, even though he was against the Vietnam War. Now, 1976, an evangelical becomes president, says, I'm born again, Jimmy Carter. And so you have the kind of resurfacing of evangelicalism into the public consciousness. So you have popular evangelicalism or above ground evangelicalism, undercurrent, everything. New Age, huh? Variety, all the different kinds of theology, liberation theology, blacks theology, gay theology, feminist theology, Native American theology, Asian liberation theology, and on and on and on. Well, we're going to have to quit, but the big story is boomers and now the post-boomers even, you know, and their story is consumerism. There's no denominational loyalty anymore. That's a thing of the past. And they have their cafeteria trays, and they're going down the line, and they're taking some things, and they're not taking other things. It's a great variety. And then the new intellectualism, there are so many currents in modern thought that are critical of any attempt to establish any kind of authority on an absolute basis. I read a book recently called After the Absolute, And I think that's where we are today. All right, tomorrow's our last session, and it will be our mixed salad.
Salad bar tomorrow.
Salad bar.
Great. Thank you. We'll have our cheerleaders. Yes.